Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Greek crisis that has rattled global financial markets following the surprise announcement by the Greek Prime Minister of a referendum on a second bailout to contain the country's crippling debt. Costa Panayiotakis, Professor of Sociology at the City University of New York, joins us to explain why this bombshell was dropped and whether it will lead to the very disorderly default that the European leaders had just made an agreement with the Greek government to avoid. Then we'll discuss the piles of money being thrown at the members of the Congressional Supercommittee by the defense industries who are trying to avoid across-the-board cuts to the bloated defense budget. Mary Boyle, the Vice President of Communications at the campaign finance watchdog group Common Cause, joins us to describe how the Supercommittee has become a magnet for money, with lobbyists flocking to it like moths to a flame. Then we are joined in the studio by Javed Jabbar, a former Pakistani senator and federal minister who since 1992 has been a member of the longest-running Pakistani-Indian Track 2 peace process known as the Neemrana Dialogue. We will discuss the vexed relationship between Pakistan and the U.S., as well as Pakistan's long-standing and seemingly intractable standoff with India. Joining us now is Costas Panayiotakis, who teaches sociology at New York City College of Technology at the City University of New York. He's the author of the new book, Remaking Scarcity, From Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. And Costas, it would seem that Greece is in a crisis, a political freefall, if you will. As we speak, we don't know whether the Greek government is going to collapse. And I'm finding it very hard to understand what the motives are of the Greek Prime Minister to call for a referendum to bolster his chances of winning the confidence vote. But if the referendum happens in a month or so, the Greek people may well vote against it. And so what's the point of it? I mean, can you explain to me what's going on here?
Yeah, basically what has happened is these austerity measures have made the crisis even deeper, and basically you cannot repay your debt if your income is shrinking. I mean, it's the same as an individual. You know, if you have huge debt, you cannot repay your debt unless your income goes up. If your income goes down, then it becomes even harder. It becomes like a vicious circle. So people are starting to realize that this does not lead anywhere, and they are sort of opposed to that. And what the Prime Minister is trying to do is basically he knows that if he calls for elections, for early elections, he's going to lose. And he's calling for a referendum instead to get some legitimacy. And he's plan seems to be to basically blackmail the Greek population and tell them, you know, either you accept my policies and we stay in the Eurozone, or else if you say no, then it will be the end of the European experience. And this has been the tactic all along. There has been a lot of resistance in the past, many general strikes, large demonstrations. The tactic of the government has basically been to instill fear in people and try to convince people that, you know, it's our way or else, you know, very terrible things will happen. So Greeks have seen that the terrible things are happening while the policies, the governing party's policies are being implemented. And this kind of tactic of instilling fear in people becomes less and less plausible. So the governing party has been losing support, and I think this is kind of a move of desperation for the governing party to prolong its hold on power.
So, Costas Panayiotakis, that perhaps explains why it doesn't make any sense, because if Papandreou is trying to hold on to power and he's having defections within the PASOK socialist ruling party, he's trying to hold on to his mandate, but if he's using this referendum as a way to force the Greek people to stick with him and with his plans, it's surely going to backfire. I'm not in Greece, but I'm absolutely convinced that the Greek people are going to vote it down. Aren't they just absolutely furious with the situation they're in, and aren't they likely to vote for what will in effect be a disorderly default, and where they'll end up with an even greater debt because the deal that was just made shaved off half of the debt?
Well, I think it's partly a matter of how the question is framed. So a recent poll showed that 60% of Greeks have a negative view of the recent European deal. But at the same time, there are other polls that show that if you ask Greeks, are you in favor of the Eurozone or not, 70% will say we want to stay in the Eurozone, 30% say no. So, I mean, this is, he's sort of grasping at straws. I mean, I can understand your puzzlement, but the alternative would be, you know, he knows that he cannot pass austerity measures from the parliament. He cannot basically even trust his own deputies to vote for more austerity measures. There were austerity measures that were voted on just a few days ago, and some of the deputies who did vote for these measures basically said this is the last time. So many of the deputies have been voting for these measures, even though they don't believe that these measures will lead anywhere. So basically, the government is very much weakened, and they need they face increasing opposition from within the ranks and from the general group population. They feel that for them to continue, they need some kind of source of external legitimacy. They know that they cannot get that through elections because, you know, 2 years ago, the Socialist Party in 2009 got 43% of the vote, espousing very different policies from the ones they're following now. And according to polls, their support now has collapsed to 15%. And the conservatives are around 30%. So, you know, the attempt to have the referendum may seem kind of as a not very sort of plausible sort of strategy for them. But the alternatives, from the point of view of the prime minister who wants to cling to power, are even worse. So it's a move of desperation, and of course it has created lots of negative response from across Europe and the world.
That's putting it mildly, Costas.
Yeah.
I mean, the Merkel and Sarkozy and these other people are furious, aren't they?
Right. And the same thing happens, you know, from within Greece and the prime minister's party. Many of his own ministers have distanced themselves from this decision. The finance minister claimed that he didn't even know about it. So it's pretty clear that even his own cabinet see him as basically sort of politically dead or near to the end of his political careers. And we already see some of the people in his cabinet preparing themselves for the next day, and they distancing themselves in order to position themselves in a way that would seem favorable to, you know, European governments, Merkel, Sarkozy, since obviously they hold a lot of power. And one of the issues, of course, one of the reasons for the opposition on this European deal among the Greek population is that basically national sovereignty is liquidated, and basically whatever the Greek government will be doing from now on, if this agreement becomes implemented, will be basically supervised and, if necessary, vetoed by the technocrats and the politicians of the European Union and the IMF.
Again, I'm speaking with Costas Panayiotakis, who teaches sociology at New York City College of Technology at the City University of New York. He's the author of the new book, Remaking Scarcity, From Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. So I guess in a way, Costas, you're describing a situation, a political situation that may be analogous to what we have here in the United States. The dreadful state of the economy in Greece is likely to bring about the re-election of the very people who put the country into debt, the conservative New Democracy Party. And here in the United States, as you know, Obama's very unpopular with the political left, and the Republicans have more money than God. Unlimited funds are going to be spent, and it's likely that the American people will vote for the very people who caused the economic crash in 2008.
Yes. I mean, it's an irony because you have center-left parties and politicians running on a platform of change, and then when they get elected, they basically do not follow through on their promises. So what happens as a result is that the base becomes disappointed and disillusioned, and they follow sort of half measures and policies that make the crisis worse and that do not address the issue of unemployment. So they end up being counterproductive even for them. And then, of course, it's easy for the right wing to capitalize on this and blame basically those politicians for the stagnation of the economy and people's suffering. And I mean, one of the hopeful developments, though, is that there are popular movements that are emerging, and that and this is where, in my view, you know, our hope lies. Our hope does not lie in the Democratic Party or the Socialist Party in Greece. Our hope lies in the fact that people are basically starting to stand up, saying enough is enough. They're starting to mobilize. So in the U.S., for example, we have the Occupy movement. It started with Occupy Wall Street. It has been spreading around the country. And this is actually a global phenomenon. There are links to Europe, and, of course, ultimately it goes all the way back to Tahrir Square in Egypt. When I was in Greece over the summer, there was the central Syntagma Square was occupied. And this was by the time there was, in the summer, there was a similar kind of political crisis in Greece that we have right now, where there was just before the voting of a new austerity program, that basically there was a day when it wasn't clear whether the prime minister, you know, had resigned or not. There were discussions for a coalition government. So basically there are lots of parallels here. The situation in Greece, of course, is more extreme than it is here, but there are certainly parallels where you have politicians who come in and they have a kind of progressive rhetoric, and as they disappoint people, you know, they end up shooting themselves in the foot, so to speak.
So, Kostas Panayiotikos, I guess the analogy doesn't work in the sense that even though the United States is indebted to China, China is not about to cut the United States loose, but the German politicians are now talking about cutting Greece loose, allowing it to default on its debt and to leave the Eurozone. And as you probably know, Kostas, there's a lot of anger in Germany about Greece, and there's a kind of cultural north-south divide in Europe where the Germans in particular don't believe the Greeks have behaved responsibility, and why should they, the German taxpayer, bail them out? Now, of course, what's always forgotten in this rancor to and fro is that it's the banks that the people are bailing out. They're not bailing out the Greek people. They're bailing out the banks, aren't they? Their own banks, the German and French banks.
Yeah, I mean, this is one, and this takes us to the other point, that the crisis in Europe is not just a crisis of specific countries that were irresponsible and so on and so forth. I mean, these are simplifications that populist politicians will oftentimes use to justify very harsh austerity policies. It's a much more complicated crisis. Debt crisis is connected to the global economic and financial crisis. It's connected to the flawed architecture of the European project in general. And it's true that basically the banking system in Europe, banks, many of the banks are practically bankrupt. In Ireland, for example, which is another country that has such a has austerity programs and has used the bailout that came from the European Union and the IMF, what you actually had was that it was the private banks that collapsed. And the reason now the Irish government is saddled with heavy debt is precisely because they bailed out the private banks.
Well, so, that happened here in the United States in 2008, a massive transfer of private debt into public debt. We are the ones with Lehman Brothers, after Lehman Brothers, we've set that example that has metastasized. That is the new economic modus vivendi, isn't it? Irresponsible lenders get bailed out by governments and taxpayers, and their debts become sovereign debt.
Right, exactly. And this is something worth remembering, because now we have the paradox of all these banks that got bailed out by governments. Now they're sort of turning their finger against governments and lecturing them about the need to be fiscally responsible. I mean, it speaks to the undemocratic nature of a capitalist economy, where you have economic elites basically controlling the economy and controlling the political system, to the extent that when they actually mess up and they bring the global economy to the edge of the abyss, they get rewarded for their behavior, and then they make everybody else who was not responsible for the crisis pay for the crisis that they caused. And that's why it's important that people are starting to realize what is going on. They're starting to mobilize. They're starting to talk about the growing inequalities, about to identify the people who brought us to this state of affairs. And I think there is a kind of ideological struggle that goes on today, as it goes on anytime there is a huge crisis. I mean, there is the sort of healthy thing to do when there is a crisis like that is to analyze the root causes of the problem, how this crisis is connected to the fundamental functioning of the system, while the other side is the other sort of reactionary way of dealing with a crisis is to look for convenient scapegoats. And this happens in Europe, as you pointed out, so there is a kind of racialization of Southern Europeans. The idea, the kind of distinction, the Germans and the Northern Europeans who supposedly are hardworking and, thrifty and so on and so forth, and the Southerners who are sort of undisciplined and they are spendthrift and so on and so forth. And the same thing happens, of course, in the U.S., where there is an attempt to channel the people's understandable anger against scapegoats, be it immigrants or be it public sector workers.
Well, just in the closing minute here, Costas Panayiotikos, let's just try and figure out what's likely to happen here, because already this grenade that Papandreou has thrown, an American footballer, I guess they'd call it a Hail Mary pass, has already rattled the European markets. Already the euro's fallen, and the Italian bonds are at an all-time high, raising Rome's borrowing costs to levels that have proved unsustainable for Ireland and Portugal. So that's already happening. What do you think is going to happen here? The government's going to fall. The referendum won't take place, I take it, if the government falls.
Well, I mean, it's hard to know what will happen. I think even if, I mean, it is a possibility that the government will fall or that they might call for elections. If that happens, Basically, you may not have a stable government that comes out of the elections because none of the two major parties is likely to have enough deputies. So they might try to make a coalition government that will try to implement similar measures. If somehow, you know, the government survives this crisis as it did last summer, it will be even weaker than it was before. And it will continue to face more and more resistance in the future. And next time, and when it comes to actually implementing the latest European deal with all the austerity measures that it will require, it may face real problems passing that through the parliament, because its majority, it started out 2 years ago with a comfortable majority in the parliament, and it has lost many of its deputies. And now its majority is a razor-thin majority. They have 152 out of 300 deputies. So it's hard to know what will happen, but this is a government that may not last very long.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Kostas Panayiotakis. Again, I've been speaking with Kostas Panayiotakis, who teaches sociology at New York City College of Technology at the City University of New York, and he has a new book, Remaking Scarcity from Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how piles of money are being thrown at the super committee.
What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to the men who move on me.
These implements and texts designed by intellects so vexed to find evidently there's so much that hides. And though the saints above divine in ancient feeding lines, their sentiment is just as hard to pluck from the vine.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Master. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mary Boyle, the Vice President for Communications at Common Cause. Previously, she covered politics and public policy for the Denver and Washington bureaus of the Gazette of Colorado Springs and was a general assignment reporter with the Associated Press in Baltimore and Denver. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mary Boyle.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And Common Cause, along with the Center for International Policy, have just released a new study, Tools of Influence, the Arms Lobby and the Super Committee. And it would seem that what people were worried about when the Super Committee was created in the deal that the White House made with the Republicans over the budget impasse, that it would become a kind of magnet, if you will, for campaign money, because rather than have the lobbyists having to spread their money around on to everybody on the Hill, they would be able to just target these members of the super committee. So is that what's happening?
Yes. I mean, there has been, for the most part, the fundraising by members of the super committee has continued throughout the period, you know, the three-month period while they are doing this work, unfortunately. There was one super committee member, Senator Kerry from Massachusetts, appears to have stepped back from it, but for everyone else, it has continued. And that's very troubling because, every lobbyist in town who wants to, get close to the super committee is contributing money.
Well, one of the key people, of course, is the Armed Services Committee Chairman, Howard Buck McKeon, and he's, of course, a Californian. I noticed that Paul Krugman in the New York Times recently wrote a very stinging article talking about the hypocrisy of Buck McKeon, in as much as he's warning about cutting defense spending because of the impact on jobs. At the same time, The Republicans on the Hill are not doing anything about restoring jobs. They're blocking attempts on the part of the White House to stimulate the economy by creating jobs. So do you recognize this hypocrisy here? I mean, is it... It does seem pretty blatant that on the one, you know, that defense industry jobs are fine, and that and they're willing to use the argument about we need jobs to keep defense spending up, mm-hmm. but not for the rest of the economy.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's part of what the defense industry has created with their, you know, ever reliable, generous contributions, not just to the super committee, but to many, many members of Congress, as well as a lot of money that they have spent over the years, lobbying. They have made it, so that almost every congressional district or many congressional districts in the country have, you know, defense plants or some sort that are employing people, and you know, makes it very hard for members of Congress to advocate for closing them down.
But it's been so clear for the longest time that the Congress, that the Pentagon don't even know where all their money goes. They've lost billions in Iraq. They have overlaying accounting that with vast holes. Billions get misappropriated or simply lost. So is there any sense that this super committee in trying to do across-the-board cuts is going to actually cut the fat? I mean, isn't there?
Well, I mean, certainly that's the hope. I mean, we fully believe that there is plenty of room to make cuts that are not going to endanger security. If the super committee and the White House will, you know, put aside their political interest in cultivating big contributions from defense contractors and act in the national interest instead of the interest of their contributors.
So, who's getting the most money then, in terms of the Congress, the representatives of both from the House and Senate on the super committee that are overseeing these what will be mandatory cuts? Right, that's the idea that the super committee is a trigger that will be pulled if the Congress can't come to terms on a budget, which so far they haven't. So it's a, you know, there's a likely that this mechanism will be employed, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly Congressman McKeon has received over $750,000 from the defense industry just since 2009. And he is the largest recipient of the defense industry in Congress. So he is at the top of the heap.
And anybody else that you would single out?
Sure. We know that Senator Patty Murray has gotten a lot of money, about $250,000. Between 2007 2011, she is a top recipient. Senator Baucus, almost every member of the super committee has received defense industry contributions, and this is what the defense industry is so good at, as giving lots of money to many, many, many members of Congress.
So, what is the sense, though, in Washington? Mary Boyle, since you're there, and in many ways I'm glad I'm not inside the Beltway. Mm-hmm. I think one has a sort of different perspective in the sense that you're not caught up in the process. But in the broader sense, isn't it pretty clear that these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have added billions and billions to the defense industries and to military contractors, and that the United States now spends more than all the rest of the world combined on defense? And it is, I think, fairly unsustainable, isn't it, in given the budget crunch that we're in?
Yeah, certainly. And, I mean, to get to... This committee has to trim something like $1.5 trillion, which is obviously a lot of money. And, you know, clearly, as you pointed out, we are constantly seeing, reading about examples of fraud and millions, if not billions of dollars of defense spending that was wasted. And this would seem like a place where they could do some significant cutting.
And in terms of the lobbying, Mary Boyle, again, Vice President for Communications at Common Cause, along with the Center for International Policy, have come up with a new report, Tools of Influence, the Arms Lobby and the Super Committee. The arms industry have spent $144 million on lobbying, right, in 2010. There are no figures ready for this year, is that?
That's right. That's correct.
But the assumption would be that given the existence of the Super Committee, it might even be bigger this year, right?
Yeah, and I would point out that the industry employs over 1,000 lobbyists, which is about 2 for every member of Congress, which is a lot.
So they're swarming over the hill just by sheer numbers. They've
mm-hmm.
taken the high ground, right?
And they also have a lot of former Capitol Hill staff who now lobby for them. So they know the inside game. They have a lot of the access that they need to get to people.
Well, specifically, there are 682 military contractors employed in this revolving door, right?
That's a
good chunk of the 1,000.
That's right. And, you know, the reason that we did this report is, I mean, to us, this, when you have special interests like the defense industry, this is our example here, who are basically funding the campaigns of all these members of Congress, that it is, you know, very difficult, if not impossible, for members of Congress to be making the kinds of difficult public policy decisions they have to make here in the public's interest, as opposed to in their campaign contributors' interest. I mean, we have this system now where the big donors are the ones who decisions are being made for. They're not being made, you know, for you and for me. And that's what's got to change.
Well, given that the Super Committee members have received over $1.1 million in donations from weapons contractors in the last 2 election cycles, the evidence is pretty clear that already the door is revolving right out of the Super Committee. If you've got 5 former Super Committee staffers now working for the top military contractors, including mm-hmm. Boeing, General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon, and in all 22 former staffers of Super Committee members serve as lobbyists for the arms industry. So they've already, it's a two-way street, right?
It is a two-way street. I mean, they're not only giving the money, but they have hired lobbyists who are former staffers to some of these members of Congress. And that, you know, is also another way of assuring access and influence.
So what is the sense? I mean, I didn't mean to impugn you in any way, Mary, as a member of the Beltway, but what is the sense we've got people around this country starting out occupying Wall Street and now all across the country mm-hmm. and around the world for that matter. There are people expressing a kind of outrage that they don't feel that their government represents them. It just feels like we're in an alternative universe here. This is just business as usual for this bloated defense industry. And it looks like they've found an incredible – the Congress people have found an incredible bonanza here. This is like the super committees are like the flame that the moths, gravitate towards.
That's right. And I mean, the super committee has obviously yet to report out, so we can see what they do, but it's not a heartening sign to look at these numbers and see the fundraising that continued during the very, you know, presumably difficult deliberations that this super committee is making. And You know, there's a lot of obviously speculation about what they are going to come down with and what's going to happen. I can tell you from a Washington perspective, there's been a lot of talk about the secrecy involved in this committee. There are even a lot of members of Congress complaining that they don't know what the super committee is doing. And, you know, given that they are making, they're going to be making very, critical decisions that are going to impact millions of people, it is very troubling that it's kind of been done all behind closed doors.
So when they report out with their cuts, what happens? Because the sword of Damocles that's holding over them, the idea of this mechanism of super committees, is that if they can't come to an agreement, then there are mandatory cuts, right?
That's right.
So they're trying to avoid that. So how do they? What's the expectation then that they'll make less cuts, or they'll? I mean, what's the game that's going to be played here?
You know, I think that's a very good question, and that's what a lot of people are asking. I mean, clearly everyone is going to want to avoid across-the-board cuts, but this is an unprecedented committee that has unprecedented powers that has been operating behind closed doors. So I think that really no one knows what's going to happen.
Well, I guess we'll wait and see, but it's our money, right?
It is our money, and
there's less and less of us. There's less and less of it, and there's more and more of us out of work. You know.
That's right. That's right. And we're the ones who are going to be living within the limitations of what they pass out. Mm. So a lot of eyes watching this.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Mary Boyle.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Mary Boyle, who's Vice President for Communications at Common Cause. Previously, she covered politics and public policy for the Denver and Washington bureaus of the Gazette of Colorado Springs, and she was a general assignment reporter for the Associated Press in Baltimore and Denver. And Common Cause have just issued a new report, Tools of Influence, the Arms Lobby, and the Super Committee. Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back, joined in the studio by a former Pakistani senator and federal minister. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Javed Jabbar, who's a distinguished Pakistani intellectual, author, filmmaker, and activist. He's the chairman and chief executive of JJ Media in Karachi, Pakistan, a firm dedicated to producing distinctive content for diverse media. A former senator and federal minister of Pakistan, he takes an active interest in diverse fields, including international affairs, voluntary work for rural and urban development, the environment, social issues, and mass media. He is associated with conflict resolution and cooperation initiatives between Pakistan and India in the South Asia, and since 1992 has been a member of the longest-running Pakistani-India Track 2 process known as the Nimrana Dialogue. Javed Jabbar's most recent book is Pakistan, Unique Origins, Unique Destiny. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Thank you.
Javed Jabbar.
Thank you very much for your
clearly, the relationship between the United States and Pakistan is quite vexed.
Yes.
And I think in many ways a turning point happened recently with the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen's testimony that was quite blunt, and what had previously been expressed behind closed doors in terms of frustration between the so-called allies, the U.S.
Yes.
And Pakistan, came out in the open. And now we have Secretary of State trying to sort of repair things
yes.
and And she's asking for the Pakistanis, and particularly the military and the ISI, to do things that they so far have not wanted to do. So let's start with that, you know, in terms of the Haqqani network. Is Hillary Clinton's plan, it's actually referred to in American military jargon as fight, talk, and build. Is that dead on arrival?
No. I don't think it's necessarily dead on arrival. Its success will depend on engagement and dialogue with the Taliban. Without wanting to divide the Taliban on the assumption that the Haqqanis can be separated from the main Taliban leadership, that process that Secretary of State Clinton has outlined is dependent on accepting their basic unity of command. If that premise is accepted, then it is possible to continue dialogue. Remember that the first dialogue has already taken place. At Pakistan's suggestion, we facilitated the dialogue because we want dialogue rather than violence to continue. And it is possible to talk, to continue fighting where necessary and unavoidable, if there are outright attacks on U.S. or NATO property. Obviously, the reaction is going to be equally violent, and then build wherever feasible. But the build part has been very, very mixed. In areas where corruption is rife, because the war has unleashed a huge amount of corruption. War has become good business, unfortunately, for the people and the society of Afghanistan.
And Pakistan, surely, because the supplies go through Pakistan,
yes,
do they not?
But we are, in one sense, innocent victims. If Pakistanis can be innocent, let me say that we have been innocent victims of being the next door neighbor of Afghanistan. We are locked in by geography. And all of Afghanistan's principal transit imports and exports are through the territory of Pakistan. In fact, we suffer because many goods are imported into Afghanistan and then smuggled back into Pakistan, adversely affecting our own industry and services. So the build part is the key test, whether you can credibly engage the people of Afghanistan side by side with this corruption that has flourished for the past 10 years and reduce the corruption, make sure that facilities, whether they are roads or hospitals or schools, once built, continue functioning. That's the second test, because it's not just enough to put up a structure. What happens inside that structure? And the third phase will be when NATO and the U.S. withdraw, what happens to those structures.
So, isn't that where the impasse is, that where we're talking past, the allies are talking past themselves, in the sense that Pakistan knows that the United States is leaving. Yeah. They want influence and stability next door. Yeah. And my understanding is that the Haqqanis represent to them a better asset than the Quetta Shura even. And at least
that's the perception that may have been given by some reports. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in the New York Times.
I know.
Et cetera. So tell us about what Pakistan wants in terms of filling that vacuum.
First of all, you know, the historic continuity and indispensability of conducting harmonious relations with people in Afghanistan, that is a given. We cannot risk creating new conflicts with people who have always been neighbors and will remain our neighbors, whether the U.S. is present or not present. The fact of ethnicity, language that bind tens of thousands of people who straddle both sides of the border. To give you an idea, there are villages in at least three locations on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border where villages are divided right down the middle. Half of the village is in Afghanistan, half in Pakistan. Now, that's how closely integrated these communities have been. And to live as two independent nation states has never been easy. Afghanistan, incidentally, was the only country in 1947 which opposed the application of Pakistan for admission to the United Nations. They withdrew the objection after 3 months, but that gives you an indication of how hypersensitive and complex the relationship is. So we want a stable and harmonious Afghanistan. But for that to happen, as I said earlier, we don't think it is useful for the U.S. to pursue a policy where the Haqqanis and what is called the Quetta Shura, the other leadership of the Taliban, can be separated. We think that we should respect the fact that even the Haqqanis have said publicly that we will not have a dialogue outside the discipline of the Taliban leadership. So if we accept that they are part of the same entity, it will help and facilitate matters. To the extent that you can have purposeful dialogue where viewpoints are so diametrically opposite to each other in terms of the time frame for withdrawal, that is the key. How and when and how quickly there is an agreement on a smooth withdrawal of forces.
But throughout this conversation, Javed Jabbar, we haven't even talked about the government of Afghanistan. And so where does that fit in? I mean, what is Pakistan's attitude to Karzai? He went to India to make a strategic arrangement, about details of which are still very opaque. We're not even talking about them. We're talking about the so-called enemy of the United States and of Pakistan. Tell us about what's going to happen with the this current government, whether it's fictional or not. It's still there.
Yes, the current government of Afghanistan has gone through some phases of very interesting evolution. In the beginning, it disproportionately included representatives of the Northern Alliance, who are Tajiks or Uzbeks or Hazaras by ethnic identity, and do not represent the overwhelming majority of Pashtuns. And it was at Pakistan's constant urging that President Karzai corrected the imbalance in his cabinet and gave greater representation to his own Pashtuns. So that helped improve matters, both from Afghanistan's point of view and our viewpoint. As regards the recent visit to New Delhi, while elements of this visit disturbed us because of its timing and some of the pronouncements that he made, lo and behold, 3 days later, he makes the startling announcement, startling even to us, where he says that if there were a war between the United States and Pakistan, Afghanistan would side with Pakistan. Now, that should...
that's a surprise, but is there going to be a war?
No.
I mean, it seems, you can argue that the U.S. has done some stupid things, the invasion of Iraq being one of the most pronounced acts of stupidity in recent geopolitical history. It seems to me that there's no chance in the world that the U.S. is going to... They want the cooperation of Pakistan. They don't want the enmity. I mean, they may be frustrated with the relationship, but I can't imagine they want it to get it worse. So what's Karzai talking about?
Exactly. One would like to know. I mean, one would like to know what he means by this, I'm sorry to say, a very absurd statement, because there is no question of either the people or the government of Pakistan wanting a war with the United States. It would be insane. It would be against our fundamental interests. And forget interests, it would be against our orientation and our attitude to the United States. Contrary to the impression that you might get or hear about, that there is anti-Americanism in Pakistan, that people burn U.S. flags or they burn effigies of U.S. leaders, the overwhelming majority of the people respect the United States for what it is. It's a very dynamic, creative society, and they recognize the fact that it is a global power. It would not be in their interest. It would not be in the interest of the future of Pakistan to go to war. And in any case, the inequality of both countries is so great, there's no question of it being a fair war, if ever there is such a thing as a fair war.
Sure. And there's no question Pakistan's got India to worry about. Yes, they don't need to pick a fight absolutely. With their ally. Now, I agree. I think manifestly makes no sense.
Yeah.
Again, I'm speaking with Javed Jabbar, a distinguished Pakistani intellectual, author, filmmaker, and activist. He's chairman and chief executive of JJ Media in Karachi, Pakistan, and a former senator and federal minister of Pakistan. You've also been, since 1992, a member of the longest-running Pakistani-India Track 2 process known as the Nimrana Dialogue.
Yes.
So it's hardly a coincidence that whenever or when the Pakistani leadership and the civilian leadership and the Indian leadership were poised to get together, there was the Mumbai attack. I mean, we know there's a mechanism that goes on here that frustrates it. We also know that there's a tremendous intransigence on the part of India over Kashmir because the late U.S. Representative, Special Representative Richard Holbrooke, who was given the job of being he understood that the job of being special envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan made no sense unless you went straight for Kashmir. Yeah. If you solve that problem, then all these other problems go away. So tell me about any possibility of a macro deal there.
It is probably the most complex relationship. The India-Pakistan relationship probably is unmatched by the relationship of any other two states in the world today. It is full of nuance, complexity, conflicts. However, there is hope and scope. Despite the perverse timing of some of these terrorist attacks, which want to subvert the state's desire or the government's desire to come to peace with India, there is a large amount of goodwill and familiarity on both sides of the border to initiate and sustain. The important thing is to sustain dialogue, regardless of these incidents. If the U.S. and Vietnam, North Vietnam, could talk in Paris while bombing continued in North Vietnam, these two sides can continue regardless of whether terrorists want to hold us hostage or otherwise. And I'm happy to report that in the last few months, the commerce ministers of both countries, for example, have met and have advanced the prospects for trade in unprecedented ways. And trade has been growing despite the political tensions. Now, even on the political front, both governments have agreed to conduct continuous dialogue. And especially on Kashmir, our Track 2 process had helped create a framework which could be used by governments, and we don't want to claim any credit for it. Ultimate credit must go to the two governments. We had created a basis for which back-channel diplomacy, where one person alone is designated by each head of government to conduct super-secret dialogue. Because of the sensitivity of this issue, these cannot be discussed, the terms of settlement, before there is basic agreement. And those four elements we have identified make it possible for both governments to take this process forward. And in case you want to ask me for those four, I'll do that. Otherwise, we can always...
Well, I just wanted to, because we're running out of time, to get a broader sense of the dynamics of whether the economic self-interest, particularly with energy coming out of the stands, which both countries could benefit from. Obviously, the pipelines would have to transit Pakistan to get to India.
True.
There's a lot of reasons why the two countries have an economic self-interest in stability. And, you know, all conspiracy theories about oil pipelines notwithstanding, there's no way that you're going to have a sustainable oil pipeline through any country that's at war because they're so easy to sabotage. So we know that you have elements in the Pakistani military that need to justify their existence by constant tension, and the same I'm sure applies on the Indian side because that's the nature of military. You know, the Pentagon here has to justify its massive budget where we outspend the world combined, and then resisting any cuts at this moment. So that's the picture that I wanted to get. It's who's going to win, commercial interests or military intransigence?
To speak for the much maligned poor military, if the military can be poor by any standards. It's rarely poor in any part of the world. But may I say that on the basis of interactions regularly with the military, retired and serving, I serve as a member of what is called the Civil Military Dialogue Group. Our military is to some considerable extent misunderstood. The very genesis of Pakistan was so insecure. The only nation state created with two wings separated by 1,000 miles of hostile territory. I like to give the example. Can you visualize the United States being born with New York on one end, California on the other, and the Soviet Union in the middle? Imagine the kind of insecurity New York and California would have felt. That's what we felt in 1947, because the Indian government was on record as saying, the Home Minister of India said, Pakistan won't last more than 6 months. Now, if you have that kind of attitude, right from the word go, the military became the guarantee of national survival and security. And even after 71, when we lost half our country, mainly due to our own blunders, but also due to active Indian help, we resolved to secure our identity and our continuity. And when India introduced nuclear weapons, we had no choice but to also develop nuclear weapon capacity. At this time, the military actively supports the peace process with India. They recognize that it is going to be wasteful, non-productive to constantly engage in tension with India. The onus, and I'm not trying to pass the buck, the onus lies on India. It is 3 times the size of our armed forces. It is 7 to 8 times the size of our population. 60% to 70% of its armed forces are deployed on the Pakistan border. So we have no choice but to wait for India to make that move. But on energy, let me say that I was very disappointed that the U.S. did not actively support the proposal for an Iran-Pakistan-India gas pipeline. Now, one respects America's reservations with Iran, even though I disagree with the mutual lack of perception and dialogue. But that could have been a very salutary project where you bring together 3 immediate countries, Iran, Pakistan, India, and that could well have helped improve relations even with the United States. So energy, certainly. Incidentally, we are sitting on one of the world's largest coal deposits, and India uses coal on a very significant scale. Coal for us is only a small percentage of our energy consumption. We could benefit by joint ventures with India in developing coal, clean coal, and we could benefit from U.S. advice because I believe clean coal is a major concern in U.S. energy plans. And therefore, also with the Tans, as you mentioned, the oil pipeline, but stability in Afghanistan is a prerequisite for any pipeline to run through Afghanistan into Pakistan.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time and we've barely scratched the surface of this complex relationship between these two countries, not to mention the complexities of Pakistan itself.
Yes.
But I do thank you for joining us, Javed Jabbar.
Thank you very much for your hospitality.
Again, I've been speaking with Javed Jabbar, distinguished Pakistani intellectual, author, filmmaker, and activist. He's chairman and chief executive of JJ Media in Karachi, Pakistan. He's a former senator and federal minister in Pakistan, and since 1992 has been a member of the longest-running Pakistan-India Track 2 process known as the Neem Rana Dialogue. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time one night in America.
Bye.